I mean, obviously you can't do justice to the subject in a brief introduction, but what I thought I'd do is just deal with some basic themes, and then perhaps we can go into the detail or even into the philosophical detail and flesh it out. Okay. I think the first thing is that in starting the discussion about alienation, you know, Marx starts from what he considers to be the essence of humanity, the nature of humanity, what constitutes human beings. And he makes a very simple point that human existence is impossible without creative, productive activity. In other words, men and women cooperating to produce things. And, you know, a human community would not be able to exist without that activity. So underneath all the underneath all class exploitation, underneath class society, you've got this basic human fact that is submerged beneath class oppression and exploitation. So he starts off by asking how do human beings differ from, say, animals? Because human beings are part of nature, just like animals. And he's saying that human beings can produce things and they're active and they have a conscious aim even when they don't have any physical need. So an animal might be hungry and kill its prey and eat. But a human being can be active and produce things even though he might not be hungry. And I'll just give you the famous quote from Capital Volume 1. He's just bringing out what the essence of what humanity is. He's saying, a spider conducts operations that resemble a weaver, and a bee puts to shame many an architect in the construction of its cells. But what distinguishes the worst architect from the best of bees is this: the architect raises the structure in the imagination before building it in reality. In other words, the essence of humanity is that human beings have got a conscious purpose. And in this case, the architect has his imagination, his idea of what the structure is before he actually builds it. So Marx is putting, he's talking about human beings being in nature, part of nature, and transforming nature and themselves historically. Now, over the centuries, class society, different types of class society, for example, feudalism, for example, capitalism, have perverted this productive activity, perverted this cooperation between human beings, and have distorted it into something that isn't human. So in terms of alienation, class society means alienation. It's not based, for example, capitalism is not based on human beings. It's not based on human cooperation. It's not based on working for human need, working for the community. It's an alienated society. It's not a human society. And I think in Capital, he analyses the genesis of capitalism, that alienation is caused by the separation of the worker from the means of production. In other words, the separation of workers from the tools or the abilities to produce for themselves. And I can give an illustration. I used to live in this village in Derbyshire, and on the hills above the village, there were all these dry stone walls that had been there since the 17th century, parceling the land up into little fields. Now, what happened historically was a group of the most prominent landowners met in a pub, in a hostelry, and what they did is divided the common land between themselves. They all agreed, they met in the hostelry, they agreed who got what, and then that was authorised by Parliament, that was in Parliament. You had the landed aristocracy, so all MPs were landed aristocrats. So they authorised it. And the ideological justification was they made the land more productive. And so it ceased to be common land. And one of the things that struck me about these walls were they're extremely high, and they'd gone to great expense to build them because private property was a novelty. And the rights of way alongside these walls were what's left of the common land. Now, if you were an agricultural labourer in that area, then you had the common land, which meant if you had a few cattle, you could graze the cattle on the common land. If you wanted fuel for your fire, you could go and chop wood in the woods. You could just take the wood. So you could get by and be independent and not be dependent on anybody else. Now, what this separation from the land did, well, in the area where I used to live, is that people then had to go and work in the cotton mill. The first cotton mills, the first factories, if you like, in the world, and the first industrial proletariat were men and women. Were women and children. And I've got some of these photographs, the old photographs. You see the local bourgeois in their bowler hats. And then most of the workforce are children, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, with bare feet, and a lot of women as well. So what it meant was they were separated from the land, were separated from the means of production, and it meant they had nothing to sell but their labour power, their capacity to work. And that was alienated to the local mill owner, to the local capitalist, to the local bourgeois. So that's the process where, and it happens in different ways, but that's just one of the way it happens, where people's capacity to work, ability to work, is alienated. They lose control of it. And in this case, they had to work for 12 hours in a cotton mill. And I think, as Marx said, the loss of control over their working conditions meant it ruined the mind and ruined the body, and they were subjected to harsh conditions and monotonous work. And that's been a lot of the story of technology, where technology is not used to liberate people, to give them more leisure time, to give them more comfort. Technology has been used to subject people to mindless operations. De-skilling, for example, is a modern thing where operations are reduced to narrow, mindless little functions. I mean, even the bourgeois economist like Adam Smith recognised this. He talked about an early modern factory in Scotland, the pin factory, where you had all these little tiny operations and everyone did one little operation as a division of labour. And he was talking about how mindless that was. In other words, what you had there is alienation, where people are creating things, but they're doing it under somebody else's direction. It means that the productive forces or the technology stands above them and over them. In that pin factory, obviously, people were working in a very mindless environment. And I think Marx refers to this as a kind of living death, if you like, that work means the death of life. It doesn't mean life. And here's another quote. When I work in order to live, in order to produce the means to a living, my work is not my life. In other words, work is an alienated activity. So you can have a trade union, you can have better wages, but you'd just be a better paid wage slave. So the products and all the things created by the workers, all the things created by them, their labour power creating things, stands outside them, so that you have an estrangement or alienation. They have absolutely no control over it, and it dominates them. And I think the whole system is out of control anyway. It's a bit like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, where it's accumulation for accumulation's sake. So it's even out of control of the capitalist. It's an irrational system essentially, and here's another quote, "It's not the worker who makes use of the means of production, but the means of production which makes use of the worker." You know, again, you've got that alienated thing about people being dominated by things. And the important thing about all these various things, like capital, for example, is that they're products of labour. Whereas the illusion is, the alienated existence is that capital creates, it's capital that creates things, it's money that creates things. That is just alienation. Money is a thing, it's ultimately a lump of metal, isn't it, gold or silver. So things dominate human beings. Hopefully some other people can talk about this, about kind of social relations assuming a fantastic form of relations between things, where you don't get it. People don't work directly in terms of human need. They don't work collectively directly in terms of human need. There is, in modern production, people do work collectively together, but it doesn't appear to be like that. That's a kind of phantom, if you like, because what really dominates is money, is capital. It is an alienated kind of phenomena, which, you know, appears to be factual. You know, money, capital, they're factual. But I think the point that's made is that they're not really. It's just an illusion. It's an ideology. Underneath it all, it's just very simple. It's just ordinary human beings, men and women, working to produce things. And you've got these, like, instead of having a direct social relationship, you've got these second-order mediations. Capital, wage labour, exchange. And the thing about capitalism in wage labour and in exchange values and in value production, it can't treat a human being as a human being. It can only treat labour in the abstract labour power. It can't treat a human being as a specific person who produces with other people. So you get a kind of a strange kind of world that the productive forces that people have created kind of dominate them, and kind of I think Marx calls it he refers to capital and surplus value and exploitation of workers. He refers to it as a kind of vampire-like process that sucks the blood out of workers, that sucks the life out of workers. So it's kind of lifeless existence. You don't actually. It's not part of the human process at work. And the other aspect of alienation is that there's a separation of politics from the human community, that people are not directly making political decisions. They're not making decisions about things themselves. So you get the state over and above society, over and above individuals. And the point about the capitalist state is that it's a complete abstraction. It's a bit like surplus value or value. It's a complete abstraction. It's a bit like the Christian view of heaven. So in heaven, we're all, you know, children of God. We're all equal. And the same way in the bourgeois state, we're all citizens. So I'm equal with, there's an abstract equality. I'm equal with Richard Branson or Rupert Murdoch or David Cameron, for example. We're all equal. But of course, there's no real equality. That's a complete abstraction. It's just bourgeois man, I think Rousseau said, is nothing, is a nothing. There's no substance to it. Because I think very early on, people like Hobbes recognised what capitalism was, because you have the state like a heaven, but on earth or in the market society, you've got selfish individualism. You've got a war of each against all. You've got selfish pursuits, private pursuits. And I think people like, thinkers like, for example, Rousseau, recognised very early on in terms of capitalist relationships that the whole thing is, there's no society, that what you have instead is deceit and greed. If you're selling something to somebody in your own self-interest, then you've got to make out it's a bargain to the other person, but it isn't really. You're out for your own self-interest, so it's deceit. So you can't have community when you've got competing individual interests. I think Adam Smith, you know, who's a kind of bourgeois economist, made the point that the butcher, the baker, and the brewer, they provide you dinner, but they don't do it out of benevolence, they do it out of self-interest. And, you know, somehow or other, self-interest results in the common good. Now, he could never explain it. All he could do is refer to the invisible hand, which is God, really. You know, the invisible hand doesn't exist. It's just just another way of saying, ultimately, providence will turn the this individual selfishness, this individual private interest into the common good. But there is no common good in capitalism, in the free market. There is no society, as Margaret Thatcher said. And so the only way to put a stop to this alienation of the state above and separate from human community is to abolish the state, to bring politics back to the community, so that I think Rousseau said that that the English people think they're free. This is very early on, before the real development of capitalism. He said the English people think they're free, but they're very much mistaken, because once they've voted for their parliamentarians to represent them every 5 years or so, then they've alienated their own political existence. So they're unfree, which is, I think, the point that Marx made. Because I think Marx made the point about the Paris Commune as a kind of historical example, where he said, instead of deciding once every 5 years which parliamentarian was to misrepresent the people in Parliament, universal suffrage would serve the people in the communes. So what he was saying about the Paris Commune was that it ended the separation of politics and economics. You didn't have a separate state. You didn't have that estrangement between people and the state, that people just, you had delegates from the workplaces, and they just managed, they made all the decisions in the commune. Now, I think he did talk about any official or delegate having the average wage of an average worker, but if you have that wage relationship, you're back to abstractions, really. So, I think if you're going to have real freedom, you've got to get away from wage labour. But I think what Marx did was to make the point that men and women can only truly produce for human need in unalienated conditions, in freedom. In other words, work or producing things to exist and have a life had to be freely chosen, whereas wage labour is forced work. It's not freely chosen. And so the message is really about freedom. And until you have freedom and unalienated conditions, then you won't truly have a human society.
used to say on the subject of alienation.
A few things that I thought about what you need to know. But one of them is that I think you can't sort of like have a discussion about alienation today without mentioning the Situationists, who obviously like built a lot of their theory and facts around that. And I think one of the really interesting things about alienation is it's a kind of constant of capitalism, which it may sound on the surface of it that there are lots of things that define capitalism, but in fact, as Marx noted, it's noted, but it's constantly to. Tendency to constantly change everything, and I think if you don't understand that, then your revolutionary vision will be a bit screwed, because it's often said that like communism or communist socialist ideas are outdated because we don't still have a working class that looks like the industrial working class of Marx's time or anything, but capitalism can produce like increasing sort of consumer goods and stuff, but I think one of the very few things it can't do away with is it can't like stop being alienated, which at the moment this might sound a bit irrelevant, because at the moment there's like plenty of direct material reasons to revolt as well, because we're living through times of austerity and that, but like at some point that's not going to last forever. At some point affluence will resume, and like if you can have struggles in an age of affluence, and think alienation is one of the key factors for that. One of the other things I think is interesting about alienation, and again, this is a bit Situationist influence, is the role that alienation plays within revolutionary organisations, because it's absolutely true that like capital and state is alienated things are created by the working class, but not controlled by them. But it's also true that if you look at, for instance, the Labour Party, then thousands and thousands of like dedicated, honest, sincere people dedicated their like time and efforts and money and everything else to build that in the belief that it'd somehow bring about socialism. But in fact, what they got was the Labour Party. So that's clearly something that's alienated and sort of like not directly under their control. And the trade unions are, again, a very obvious example of something that's not democratically controlled by those who existed with them. And De Broad said that the experience of Soviet Russia and this like massive workers' state that was nothing to do with the workers and all about the state, but was created by this like mass revolutionary movement, was testament to the fact that you can't fight alienation with alienated means. And they had this big critique of militancy and how instead of devoting themselves to like their own personal needs, people would dedicate themselves to building like the revolutionary organisation as like another abstraction, much like capital, society, whatever else. And I'm kind of like interested in what non-alienated revolutionary activity could look like, because I don't really know.
I've got quite a bit to say, but I'm going to try and keep it short.
The first thing is I guess sort of to expand on what's already been said. just to kind of emphasise that like when you talk about the alienation being an important tool in terms of period of affluence, I think that's really important, because alienation is as much a social and political condition as it is an economic one. Like I think it's Lukács who writes about this idea of thingification. That's how he very ugly calls it. But the idea that every aspect of our existence is turned into a thing under capitalism. And that includes social relationships, sexual relationships. Whole societies are kind of basically rationalized to a statistic and a way of managing, a way of management. And I think it's almost like it's this double-edged sort of sword, that in affluence we kind of see the emptiness of capitalism, while in scarcity we're sort of confronted with the irrationality of a system that is able to produce enough for everyone, but yet impoverishes us in the process. I just wanted to kind of sort of stress that sort of alienation is part of an irrational system. And there's this brilliant, when you mentioned Marx, when he talks about vampires, the vampiric qualities of capitalism. There's Bordiga talks about capitalism being the murder of the dead, which is another phrase I like, in the sense that capitalism even destroys the things that workers of generations past have created, like factories and great works and great kind of social institutions. It will destroy them all for profit. And you know, you could see that most destructively in the world as in the interwar period and World War One and World War Two, where there was massive killing and destruction in Europe because of the imperatives of profit and capitalism. This idea of the state as an abstraction, I think, is interesting. But I think it's important to note that these are things that people internalize as well, to a certain extent, this idea of leadership. It is something that I think is enforced upon us by people in power, but is also something that we internalize to a certain extent. I think this is why even in self-professed radical revolutionary movements, you still get the same old conformity to leader structures and leadership, because these are kind of very old patterns that have been replicated over years and years and years. And finally, just a question and a kind of point of criticism. The question is, if alienation is kind of the mark of kind of capitalism in its advanced stages, then how do we treat unalienated labour or de-alienated labour? Like, for example, small craftsmen, peasants are often used as an example of slightly unalienated labour. People have more control over their means of production than an industrial proletarian. And the point of critique is this idea of kind of, I think alienation is probably a problematic term, because it kind of, I don't want to get kind of too into this too early, but it implies that there's a human nature, I think, to a certain extent, or goes towards the idea that there is a human nature which is being broken up, and I'm kind of uncomfortable with that idea that there is something we can call a human nature which exists before anything. I'm more of the idea that humans have a number of potential ways of living, and that we haven't explored the best way of doing it. But I'll leave it there.
I totally agree with your point about this kind of mystification that occurs with this human essence that should exist. This seems like a really problematic mystical point, but not to go into that too much now. To talk about you're saying that alienation's a product of capitalism, but I mean, I think alienation was there before capitalism. I mean, in religious society, for example, there's alienation as our estrangement from God, and obviously Judeo-Christian religions come up with this clever short circuit of God as man or something like that to overcome that. But in capitalist society, I think we reach this, and you were touching upon it, the Lukács point about thingification or reification, where everything is turned into a thing, every relation is turned into a thing. And I think this is probably even more advanced now than when Marx is writing about alienation. And the thing about alienation is it's a historical fact. So it has historicity, so it changes. And what I wanted to think about, and I don't know really what is alienation in the modern workplace, like in a workplace of tertiary industries, as opposed to in Marx's time. It was quite clear, he had this idea of alienation, if you produce a product and the product confronts you as thing, some kind of spectre that haunts you. But if your job is a call center, or you write a computer program can confront you as a thing, but call center or service industry or something like that, how does this tie in with alienation? Because it is surely alienation, but it's at a different historical phase. And I I'm not sure how we interpret that, but I was just wanted to see if anyone had any ideas on that.
Well, with the concept of how alienation, with the idea of how alienation relates to work today and the tertiary sector, and that, I would argue that it's still just like a logical extension of the division of labour, because part of why Marx thought that alienation, that labour was so alienated, was that people like didn't actually make things that, to like much, much greater extent. They made like mini parts of things that, and then they like didn't have anything that they could call their own at the end of the day. They just like through the division of labour had contributed in some small like thousandth and thousandth of way to making thousands of chairs rather than making one thing directly, and that's part of how it seemed out of their control. And I'd argue that like the third tertiary sector stuff today, it's just like an even more advanced version of that. People instead of produce things, they do tasks that in some way enable someone somewhere to do tasks that are related to the production of things. Because my job involved just like sitting there all day removing extra zeros from reference numbers, so I can definitely relate to what you're saying about it to sort of not even appearing as a thing anymore, just appearing as like a vast, vast abstraction, whatever the next level of abstraction beyond a thing is, I suppose.
Well, I mean, the thing about removing zeros reminds me of a t-shirt I saw advertised once about, you know, sysadmin t-shirt that, you know, if you don't shut up, I'll replace you with a bash script or something like that. But I mean, yeah, I'd have thought removing zeros from the end of numbers is something you'd want to automate. I think the stuff William Morris kind of did is kind of interesting around alienation, and I think his kind of main point in what some have seen as a romanticisation of kind of pre-industrial production, I think his, the underlying kind of political thing there was he was in favour of production where the people doing the production have the freedom to be creative and the freedom to be artistic and the freedom to put their own imagination and kind of life into the things they're producing, so that you're not necessarily producing stuff in the quickest, most efficient way, in the way that you're being directed to by someone else, but you have a task that you're doing and you're doing it for the love of it. And in kind of News from Nowhere, he talks about, you know, people spending a lot of time producing things in an artistic way just for the joy of production. And I think that's, you know, that's my kind of understanding of unalienated labour, is that kind of production where people are producing in a manner that they have the freedom to be creative, essentially.
Yeah. And I think that's a human quality, and I don't think there's anything metaphysical about it. I think that's the vision of the economic and philosophical manuscripts as well. This thing about being able to create something, and you might just be doing something aesthetic, creating something that's beautiful. So it doesn't have any utility in that sense. It's just as an aesthetic quality, and that gives you fulfillment or satisfaction. And again, you can talk about those things as being like human qualities, because that's what you want to be, as you say, that's unalienated labour. You know, as you said, that there are some areas where you have artists and crafts workers who probably do have partial unalienated existence, certainly in their work. And I think the vision is that you want to have a situation where people have some kind of enjoyment out of their work. They might not be able to have enjoyment all the time. I think in William Morris' News from Nowhere, I think everyone takes a turn at doing various things. Sometimes they have to do some kind of chores or drudgery, which isn't particularly enjoyable, but then they can choose something else that is enjoyable and so on. And it's all about what the community needs. So that at least some of the time you're doing something creative. So I don't think alienation necessarily has to be something metaphysical about something lost. What you were talking about there, about enjoying your work in terms of creating something beautiful, then that's not a metaphysical loss of something. But somebody who doesn't do that, you could be a craft worker doing something really interesting that you enjoyed. I come along, I'm working in an office, I do monotonous work. I listen to you, you tell me about what your work's like. I feel alienated. So it's, I compare my routine office work, mindless routines, with your work, and I can say, I think I'm in an alienated situation. So, the word alienation doesn't have to mean something metaphysical or something mysterious. It just means estrangement, or you can't identify or connect with what you're doing. I mean, a lot of people now work in an office. They don't work in a cotton mill, but you've still got alienation. I don't decide anything at work. I'm simply instructed what to do, and it's all routine work. I don't get dirty, but my mind certainly gets damaged. doing that every day. So, so in talking in that sense, you're not talking about something lost, say, in an Hegelian sense. Hegel, the loss of God or something. We have to, find some connection with the universal absolute. I don't think it's really, doesn't necessarily have to stray into those kind of metaphysics. It doesn't have to be a loss, but there must be human nature. There's no fixed human nature. The bourgeois economists, the classical bourgeois economists like Adam Smith, they would say, capitalism is human nature. There's a human propensity to barter and to trade. So how do you explain wage labour? How do you explain the market? Well, it's human nature. There's a human propensity to barter and to trade. That's human nature. Now, obviously, we don't accept that version of human nature, but there must be a human nature. If you talk about getting satisfaction from producing something beautiful, you're talking about human nature there. You're not talking about fixed human nature. You're talking about human nature as it's been transformed over the years. About
I think it's actually really interesting that the two subjects of the William Morris kind of example, like the craft kind of movement and that idea of kind of creativity leading to kind of a course of alienated labour and immaterial labour and the service sector coming up at the same time. Because, I mean, what I've been reading a lot about recently is sort of like university work, because I work in the university, and kind of the extent to which the knowledge economy reproduces itself. And I think something that's quite interesting is even sort of pretty what seem like routine tasks like service sector jobs in fast food restaurants or call centre jobs do actually depend on a degree of autonomy and creativity and creative input. And actually, the best kind of service sector industries positively encourage that in their employees. So it's almost like, yes, it's not a thing that's being kind of put against you. It's not, a chair, like the example, but it's your creative powers that are actually being alienated from you, which, it seems more insidious to me in some way, I'm not sure. I remember reading about this kind of idea that you know, the employees basically often have the freedom to pursue a mission statement of a business in any way, but never question the mission statement. I think when you look at it, if that's what alienation means, then I think it's about power essentially, and being powerless. Yeah, that's all.
The other point is about false needs. I think you were talking about modern society and there being more commodities now than, say, in 19th century industrial capitalism. But because there's no human aim of production, because production is for profit and surplus value and abstractions like that, because capitalism is irrational and doesn't produce directly for human need, you just get false needs. I mean, advertising, for example, and lots of things that are not really needs at all. But people are just persuaded that they are human needs, which they're not. On this point about politics and, you know, this point about the emperor has no clothes. You know, the queen is supposed to be, you know, somebody who symbolises national unity. Now, if you look at the queen, one of the richest people in the world, if you look at her lifestyle, the way she lives, etc., there's no way she could represent people in this room or generally people in society, but a lot of people believe that she does. Now, and so it becomes a fact, but... So the emperor might not be wearing any clothes, but people believe that the emperor is wearing clothes, even though the fact is quite different. And I think this is the point about that the facts are obscured, and the facts simply disappear, and something that's not a fact takes its place. The emperor's naked, but people believe that he's got the clothes. And so there's an inversion, if you like, the fact disappears, and you just get the illusion as the fact.
So repeat myself slightly, but I was just wondering if anyone had to add on the whole idea of like a revolutionary activity as alienation and the critique of militant and all that, because as has been put forward, there's this idea that things like the Bolshevik revolutionary movement and so on failed and and went the way they did because they were essentially alienated revolutionary movements and not under the control of the people who made them up. And I was just wondering, like, how do we think we can avoid like repeating that mistake? Because there's the whole critique of the militant that the situationists and people around them put forth, and how echoing the way that at work we sacrifice ourselves to like the abstraction of capital, or the abstraction of these things that we produce at some point in political activity. Militants like sacrifice themselves for the abstraction of like the revolutionary organization, or socialism as an abstract concept or whatever, and clearly to some extent we're all involved in self-sacrifice. Like, even just by being here, there's like clearly loads more fun things we can be doing with our time than sitting around in an empty room upstairs above a pub discussing alienation. But we've all like decided that that's a worthwhile sacrifice to make on some level, and so I'm just like interested in trying to work out like why we think that's worthwhile, and yeah, just like how we can stop revolutionary activity from becoming alienated and that kind of thing.
I think that's a huge question. But I think one of the key things is this idea of mediation. What I put up is probably quite a sort of crude way of putting one thing on one side and one in the other, but sort of mediation versus immediacy. So, you know, a revolutionary organization that seeks to control struggles or manage struggles is not a revolutionary organisation, whereas one that seeks immediate transformation from the condition now onwards, I would say is one that is grounded in kind of revolutionary values. But saying that, I think it's also not a matter of standing on one side or the other. There's a balance to be struck, because there clearly is a place for a revolutionary organisation, and revolutionaries have played very important roles before and after outbreaks of dissent and struggle. I guess it's more about being aware of those dangers rather than trying to. I don't think it's possible to surpass them in the current society. Basically, I think the only way we can do that is by getting rid of capitalism, and I think that changes the rules of the game. That changes the way we have to interact with each other. Because I mean, the only reason the choice of sacrifice exists right now is because we're not free to do whatever we want. You know, you can't just wake up one day and go, I'm going to be an anarchist revolutionary, because you know you have to eat, and you probably have the police around your house. I think it's a balance. I think mediation is the key, but it's something that you have to be aware of as someone who stands for radical values. But I can't see how you can get out of it, and I think that's maybe a mistake that's kind of my criticism of the situationists, basically, that they kind of believed that they could create counter spectacles or whatever, live kind of create unalienated practice, and I don't think it's actually possible to do that.
I think the situationists which are doing that. the situationists that would, you know, just to come back to that particular thing we're talking about, that in purely temporary spaces, I don't think they were putting forward. They could do that without a major change in society as a general thing, you know, without huge change to the kind of infrastructure, the way the world works at the moment. They were saying that, but for short periods of time, we could generate space where we would be able to like remove those constraints, but only for short temporary spaces and short temporary times. Yeah. Mm. Okay, just to come back directly to that.
Yeah.
I mean the situations to me, I think were you know, fantastic. They're you know, the distinction between like kind of you know, you've got play and pleasure and work and leisure, okay, and play produces pleasure and work and leisure kind of separate your time into different. They have a really good conception about how you know. Alienation in contemporary society, you know, and we're still there, you know. Their analysis is very, very, you know, accurate, in my opinion. Okay, to the jet, and so you know, people like Bob Black and stuff writing about ludic society and things like that. You know, you were talking about alienation there a little while ago, and you know, alienation work and the ability to put to be a little. To be able to insert a bit of creativity into your own work and feel, you know, you're doing something useful and those kind of things. There's some real strength in there and be able to do those things. But you had a really good point there about how, earlier after that, about how McDonald's and things like that, you know, these global megacorps and all that franchise everything down. It's up to you to work it out to target burgers to the people on the street in your area as best you can, you know, and otherwise you don't have a job. Okay, which is really shit, because burgers are shit, okay, as we all know. there's for alienation there is in the way that you're allowed to be creative. Be only creative in like working out to sell more burgers. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you're screwed. Yeah. But capitalism bends on you being creative, as long as you're creative being more capitalistic.
Mm. But as you say, there must be space for a kind of de-alienated activity, otherwise if you're completely dominated by alienation, there's no possibility of capitalism being overthrown.
you can't really oppose the system. When he talks about McDonald's, I think there was a famous couple who took legal action against McDonald's and won. So that must have been a particularly unalienated situation where they really enjoyed winning the court victory against the McDonald's, where two ordinary people took on the entire might of McDonald's and won in the courts. But on this point about kind of revolutionary organisations and alienation, I think somebody spoke about their experience of a revolutionary organisation, and they talked about how the membership is seen as kind of instruments of history. They're a thing in a sense. They're instruments of history. In other words, they do the work of history. They're not really human beings, so that they have to go out every night selling papers, and they have all these jobs to do. You're talking about sacrifice. So they have to sacrifice themselves to history. You know, they're instruments of history that's leading to socialism, that's leading to the abolition of capitalism. So all that matters is their party tasks. So they're instruments in that sense. They carry out the party task. So no matter how many times they've gone out selling newspapers, it's not enough. You know, you've only done 5 days this week. I've done five, I've sold 100 papers. It's not enough. You have to do it for 6 or 7 days. But even though it might not be as intense as kind of Jerry Healey's Workers' Revolutionary Party, where the membership were treated as instruments of history in that sense, you still get the same phenomenon, don't you? But where, I mean, you were talking about the Russian revolutionaries, but if you have a concept of a party that reflects capitalism and has to fight capitalism on its own terms, so you've got like the minister, you've got like a cabinet government, you've got, you know, half a dozen people running the country. So the idea is you take on capitalism on its own terms, so you have six members of the Central Committee. And they're organised like a bourgeois cabinet. So they pass down the instructions. The only people who debate things and think about things is the leadership. The only thinking element of the party is the leadership. And the members don't have to think. All they have to do is carry out instructions. If you're a member of militant, you don't have to think. It's not required. In fact, they don't like it. All you have to do is agree with the ideas of the leadership. That's all you have to do. And sell the paper that puts forward their ideas. You don't have to think for yourself, and in fact, they don't like it if you think for yourself. So that must be an alienated existence, being a member of the militant group, and you just follow whatever line the Central Committee's laying down. And certainly that applies to the Socialist Workers' Party, doesn't it? Where if you're in a situation where you don't have to think, you might as well be at work. You know, so and a lot of the leaders of these groups are worse than your managers. If you have experiences in these groups and you think, hang on, this Central Committee member is worse than my boss. You know.
It's funny you mention that, because it just brings back memories of sort of the writers of the Morning Star going on strike for better pay. You know, these are people who are activists for the Communist Party of Britain, and yet they're exactly recreating the relationship between workers and a boss.
You can draw out particular bad examples like those Trotskyist groups, but I think sometimes we slip into it ourselves, like that notion of kind of leadership and kind of order givers and order takers. And I think it was an interesting thing I was reading the other day, where it was talking about the difference between sort of libertarian strains of socialism and kind of Marxist and Leninist ones. And it was basically saying, you know, how the Leninist strains tend to define themselves in terms of a thinker. So there'll be a defining author. So you'll be like an Althusserian or a Gramscian or a Leninist or a Trotskyist or a Stalinist. And there's always, or, you know, when it comes to people like the SWP, you're a Cliffite, because it's Tony Cliff who's designed your theory, and there's always someone at the top who's meant to have kind of laid out the theory of everything that's happened so far and everything that will happen, which is of course a completely unrealistic position to put yourself in, but still they do it. But then if you look at the libertarian strains, we actually define ourselves much more by how we organise than who's written the theory. So you have council communists, libertarian communists, anarchist communists, anarchist syndicalists. And I think that's a much more healthy way of addressing these kind of issues of alienated organisations. Because immediately, when you're talking about, we're a counter-communist organisation, if your focus is on the organisation, it's, okay, well, how can we take this form from what we have now into, this revolutionary situation? And it's a much better... It means you end up having debates about, freedom within the movement, sort of free speech, creativity within the membership, how do you make decisions, rather than kind of what is the correct analysis of, the three stages of Marx in all of his writings. And I think that's a healthier kind of thing to do in general. But as I said, before, I still think there's a balance in all of this, but I think that's an important point.
In terms of kind of organisations, I was once in a Trotskyist group, and with hindsight, it's the problems are having hierarchical organisations. That's a big problem. I think hierarchy in general is probably the biggest problem kind of humanity faces, and then that leads to people asking or telling other people to do stupid things, in my experience. And it's just crap, really. So and ironically, it's the kind of the daft things that stick in my mind, as with hindsight, as being the most stupid things. It wasn't being asked to get up early in the morning to go and leaflet at a factory or something. It's when the organisation centrally was short of money, and suddenly all the local branches of the organisation have to start doing jumble sales to raise money to, keep the central office going. And and suddenly you find yourself out, leafleting in the rich parts of town where you're going to collect the jumble that you can make more money from in order to run a car boot sale or whatever to raise money for the organisation. You end up spending your time doing that, and it's just, it's just ridiculous. And... I think any organisation that tells anyone else what to do is just basically shouldn't exist.
Just accepting that on the way that it's the sort of like ridiculous elements of being members of hierarchical groups that stick in your head. I was, for my sins, a member of the Socialist Workers' Party at the time that Galloway went on Big Brother, and I think that in hindsight is a perfect example of the way that that kind of hierarchical organisation can be both very, very ridiculous and quite damaging, because although it's a very silly thing, and we can laugh about it now, it did have serious consequences in terms of that project, in that it meant that from then on, everyone knew it as the party with that bloke who was a cat on Big Brother, and it was a kind of completely unaccountable decision, not even by the leadership so much as by this one single figure at the head of the party, which none of the people who put their time, energy, and resources and whatever else into building that group had any control over. They were just sort of forced to go along with it as another product of their alienated labour. Which,
also the kind of this kind of top down way of organising thing completely stamps out the idea of any kind of diversity, which is another thing that capitalism creates. Or tries to enforce a social system that doesn't embrace diversity. So, you know, you're increasingly defined, well, you're always defined by what you do as a worker. Like, I don't know, you are a plumber, you are an office worker. In fact, you're not. You're obviously not just an office worker. Like, you do tons of things in your life. And, yeah, that you need that kind of diversity to be in society and also inside your movement. And that means grassroots organisation. You know, it means people articulating their particular interests and their concerns, and having the freedom to organise around them. And whether that means sort of in a very obvious way in terms of like women's struggles or the struggles of Indigenous people or around race, or, you know, purely on a kind of interest basis. You know, people may find that they communicate a lot better through film or artistic means than, you know, writing pamphlets or giving out papers. And yeah, I think we should always be embracing that kind of diversity in the working class and reflecting it in our movement. Because I think, yeah, if the mistakes of this idea that the Bolshevik Party replicated of having kind of a government in waiting, you know, it repeats all of the mistakes of political society. You know, that autonomy should be central to our vision of a revolutionary society. You know.
Well, you know, it's one thing. I mean, anarchist organisation it should tend to organise in the way that you'd like things to be, rather than the way things that are. You know, so you know, it might always be most efficient in like a Fordian kind of sense, like whatever. You know, but you know, it's like, you know, but you know, we should be trying to you know, this is the way we want things to be. This is the way we're going to do things. You know, so. Yeah. What's the word? Yeah, you know, you should organise the prefiguring. You know, the way things should be, want things to look. But I'll just say that fits in. I can't. Somebody else said something earlier about organisation and something like that. I can't remember what it was. But yeah. So you know, if once it's not fun, you know what I mean. We'll stop doing it. You know, because it didn't get nowhere. You know. I don't really have any more to say on that particularly.
But just on this point about, I know the Trotskyist groups are easy targets, but they do illustrate the problem, really. I mean, some of the groups are tiny. They probably have 50 or 100 members, and they have a full-time professional staff, you know, maybe 8 or 9 people, and even though they've only got 50 or 100 members, and the membership have to pay about 20% of their wages towards this bureaucratic professional staff. Or the example of all these organisations who have got kind of print shops, and you find the people working in the print shop, they're not, you know, they're not getting the kind of wages they should be getting, if they're getting any wages. Usually they work for their dole money, and they're working longer hours than most workers in the print shop. And that's not, as you say, prefiguring. You're not trying to get beyond kind of bog standard or straightforward capitalist relationships, because that must be a straightforward capitalist relationship where you know, people are paying a huge amount of their wages so that people can tell them what to do. And are working to print revolutionary literature, you know, 12 hours a day or something ridiculous for dole money or for a pittance. So, you know, I agree with you that you have to try and make arrangements to prefigure a future society. You obviously can't get right out of capitalism because you're in it, but you've got to make an effort to break out of it sometimes.
Yes, we need to get out. But we've been talked about. I think it was you. You know, you mentioned Adam Smith,
yeah.
And you know, there's this human nature to barter and economy,
yeah,
and all this kind,
yeah,
of pullover,
yeah,
and you know, which capitalism is based on. But then there's the concept of the gift, okay, and the gift economy, okay, where for want of a better word there.
you know, where you get potlatch-based societies, where people, I don't know how to pronounce the word, sorry, I've just seen it written down, P-O-T-L-A-C-H, okay, where people give things away, and you get status within the society by being able to give gifts, okay? And, like, I'm gifting you with my time now, okay? that's a really bad example, okay? But, but we're all gifting each other with each other's time at this, right here and now, aren't we? Yeah, and we're gaining something from that because I'm getting some interesting conversation and learning some things and picking up on some stuff. So there's lots of examples of, so by giving time to a project, you know, you're not necessarily being exploited by it. There are other perspectives on those relationships going on there. You know, people give time to, you know, let's think. You know, people organise jumble sales, don't they? They organise jumble sales for their church roofing projects and all that. You know, whatever. You know, that might be problematic in lots of ways. You know, but they're not necessarily being exploited by religion whilst they're doing that. They're stuck in some kind of, you know, they've got some kind of loop going on there where they, you know, they're engaged with their with an organisation. They're doing something with the organisation, and they're getting something out of the social relationships they gain out of that. So perhaps an alternative, less economical perspective on the relationship of the print workers for the that you were just giving us is that they were actually, they've got a story, a narrative going on in their head that they're working for the revolution, okay? So so you know, it doesn't matter, they're getting a bit paid less than the guy down the road doing the same job. Not necessarily that's a good thing, you know, because we all need to eat, we all got to put shoes on our children's feet and things like that, you know, because we do live within a capitalist society, so we can't escape into the gift economy. Well, it's difficult to. Some people seem to manage it, but I don't think that, you know, it's difficult to do those things, you know. It's
So do you think they're unalienated because they're giving their time to the party to produce their literature and they think they're working for the revolution in the abstract?
No, well, in the abstract, perhaps, but you know, I would... Do I think they're unalienated because they're working for the revolution? Yeah, no, the revolution's not a thing that's going to happen like that. You know, not for me. It's not. You can't just work. It's not something that's going to, like, then one day it's going to be somewhere else, you know? And if you think it's like that, you probably are being exploited by people who are purveying that myth to you. You know, we should be able to build spaces, enclaves, or whatever. You know, it's going to be difficult, but... There's things like workers' cooperatives where workers come together. Of course, there are issues with those kind of situations because, you know, the workers' co-op still depends on the contracts from the capitalist businesses he's working for, you know? Okay, so, you know, but the workers within the cooperative are doing something to prevent their alienation of their labour, aren't they? Okay, they're doing something to, you know, positive within that little temporary space they've got there. Of course, that's problematic because it's not combating capitalism in general, but it's kind of, you know, it's part of the solution towards those things. You have people take control of the housing by housing cooperatives and such like, don't they? You know, okay, you know, they're not easy to be able to do these things, but there's lots of right. Well, for me, anyhow, okay, for me, you know, one should be able to work with people to build spaces. All spaces are temporary, but temporary spaces that have got some resistance to alienation. Sorry, I came late to the meeting.
Yeah, I think one place you might possibly find other examples of these kind of communities are in cyberspace. So you'll find these communities of, say, open source developers and people that will work together to solve each other's problems or work together to build a particular piece of software to do a certain thing. Now, the other problem you could see with that is that they're creating things that are basically surplus value things. I mean, who needs a nicer word processor or something like that? So is such a project always already caught up within the system of capitalism and the creation of surplus value? I don't know.
But I do think that cyberspace might be one of the examples, or one of the places you can look to see where unalienated labour does actually take place.
Sure, yeah, and I think basically the free software movement's an example of that, where, I mean, it was initially created by people just producing software because they wanted to, because it was useful to them, because they wanted code that others would be free to modify and free to use without the restrictions of on proprietary software. However, it's what's happened is it's found to be so good and so useful that it's been used extensively by the corporate world. So, you know, you get yourself a cable connection to the internet these days, and the free modem, cable modem you'll get from Virgin runs Linux. I was helping a relative the other day update their GPS device, and I couldn't do it on their computer because it was a Windows machine overrun with viruses and Trojans and all sorts, and it was just proving impossible. Did some investigation into the device, and it was this TomTom device, and it turns out that it was running Linux. However, you can't update the software on it from a Linux computer. You can only do it from a Windows computer or an Apple. Most people use free software every day, but aren't aware of it. You know, anyone going on the internet and doing a search, chances are they're going to be getting results from an Apache web server or from Google, which runs on free software, etc. So it's ended up being, and most people probably producing free software these days are probably paid by commercial corporations. However, it's the license it's released under that ensures that anyone that you pass this code on to has to pass on the same freedoms. That's the kind of key thing. And if I think free software is a bit like kind of temporary autonomous kind of zone within capitalism kind of thing, where it's, you know, it's a little space within capitalism where some people have found a way to freely produce stuff in a creative way and without people being told what to do. However, you know, it's not all like that now, even if it was at the beginning, because you've got massive things like, you know, OpenOffice, which was originally non-free software that's then been taken over by a massive corporation, Sun, turned into free software, but it's just like it's a free copy of a monolithic bit of software, which is, you know, Microsoft's Office, and it's not really, in many ways, it's not in the kind of ethos of the kind of the initial free software movement, which was, you know, small, which was more a Unix ethos of kind of small tools doing specific tasks. But anyway, I won't kind of carry on because I'll go on forever.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, like, the internet kind of like gives me gives me sort of like an into something else I've been thinking about in this discussion, which is like the relationship of like alienated labour and alienated leisure, and the way that like, when we're not being like alienated workers in whatever category, we're like required to be like alienated consumers. And because there's like a big contrast between like the two screens that we spend our lives looking at, because like no one would ever give television as an example of alienated activity. It's like a completely like top-down hierarchical and at least as I'd understand it, I'd say also alienated phenomenon, where like sort of like small number of people produce it, and then it's like passed down through these like completely vertical channels, and then you just kind of like sit there like passively consuming this thing that like you've had no input into and has no like direct bearing on your own life. And I think that that's real, like a lot of the forms of culture we contribute to, we consume rather, and think it's particularly interesting to look at the examples of like music and sport, because both of those are things that basically like anyone can do. Like anyone can sing. They may sing fucking terribly, but they can still do it too. Like most cultures, or kind of like most pre-capitalist cultures, have some things of like big sort of like collective musical gatherings, and the same with sport. Like everyone kicks a football around a park in a field, but like when we think of football, we don't think of it as being this democratic thing that anyone can do. We think of it as being this sort of like very spectacular activity where like thousands and upon thousands of people kind of like sit there like more or less passively, like maybe they contribute in some way by like shouting or like beating each other up after the match, but like essentially not contributing in any way, just like watching the spectacle entirely out of their control of like 23 people running around on a pitch. And I think it's interesting the way in which these kind of things that like if we're going to talk about nature, I'd say are kind of like essentially sort of like open and egalitarian and open to anyone have become refined into these kind of like very alienated, very hierarchical forms of like things that we consume. And if I was like going to try and draw a lesson out of this, I'd say like maybe that's because like in a hierarchical top-down world, it's like dangerous to have like too many examples of sort of like open community collaborative projects. But like I'm not sure how far we want to go down that route, because then you end up with them like terrible lifestyleist logic of if we all have a big kick around in the park, then we can get rid of capitalism, which is something else I've noticed tonight. It's kind of how it's kind of like really difficult to talk about this without sounding like some massive lifestyleist, or alternatively sounding like say, or alternatively just saying like, well, wait until the day after the revolution and then we'll sort everything out. But,
Yeah, the open office thing is actually really interesting in terms of like how, because it's essentially co-option and it's or recuperation or colonization, whatever you want to call it. But you know, when capitalism uses what we make in our struggles, and like open offices is like a kind of funny example, because yeah, they made this kind of video, oh, we're going to make like an open office that you don't have to use Microsoft, and then loads of businesses and even state agencies went, oh, brilliant, we don't have to pay Microsoft anymore, we'll have open office. So it's like, and therefore became more profitable. So it's kind of, yeah, I mean, recuperation is a part of it's when those spaces shrink, where whether it's, you know, an occupation of a factory or that kind of enclave that you can make, you know, capitalism does take it away from us and uses it. And that part and parcel is part of that alienated existence that we have no control over our products, even the products that we create in our struggles. But I just want to come back on this kind of the stuff about the cultural thing. I think you have to be really, really careful. Again, this is like a kind of a criticism that I have on some situationist stuff, and also very much like the Frankfurt School, kind of that kind of wave of cultural criticism, that like I don't think it's true that people passively consume a lot of cultural products. I think actually if you the majority experience of people is that they actually take cultural products and subvert them and interpret them in their own ways automatically, because I think that's what we do. Like it's part of how we, it's a dialogue, I don't think it's possible as a human being to just passively receive something. Like we're always in communication, and yes, like a lot of TV programs carry forward loads of values which we would oppose, like militarism, consumerism, but that doesn't necessarily mean that every single person who watches that program is going to then be indoctrinated with those values. I just think you have to be kind of a bit more careful about it. I was just thinking about like the number of people I know who were like ardent anti-militarists, like would de-lock themselves to recruitment centres, yet will still play an Xbox 360 game which involves like, you know, being in the military and playing, you know, modern warfare games. So I think, you know, we live those kind of disjointed lives. But I guess sort of my example for that is, well, I mean, in the 80s they talked a lot about kind of shoplifting as a way of kind of breaking that consumerist kind of thing, but for me it's like internet piracy, in terms of if you're an internet pirate, then the kind of spectacular element of Hollywood movies is completely removed, because all of them are freely accessible, including the independent ones. So if you're on a forum, if you're in a space where you can access like culture,
then you can just judge it by its own merits. Like, and it might be a Hollywood movie that's brilliant, but there might be twice as many which are crap. But because you're removing that kind of commodification through basically stealing, you change the kind of cultural context, I guess. And I think it kind of demonstrates that we don't just kind of passively take stuff in. I think like the alternatives that lots of people put up are just horrible. Like, I'd much rather just sort of watch, I don't know, repeats on cable TV than go to a poetry reading night or sit in a drum circle. Like, that's just my personal preference. But yeah, like, I just think, you know, we have to be a bit more critical about these things. It's going to end on my drum circle comment. It's going to be terrible.
Is there anything you actually wanted to say since you've been mostly just sitting there facilitating?
No, I mean, I think things that I wanted to say, we can say. So, no.
Being more critical is a good thing to end on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Be more critical.